Good morning. My name is Raina Wells. On behalf of Ontario Media Development Corporation, welcome to the second in our series of four digital dialogue breakfasts. As many of you know, OMDC is an agency of the Ontario government with a mandate to build Ontario's creative economy through a range of innovative programs for funding for the book and magazine publishing, film and television, music and interactive digital media industries. This morning's panel is about analyzing consumer data. After the panel discussion, we'll be opening things up for audience questions and discussion, and there will be some more time for networking afterwards, so please stick around if you're able. I'd like to thank PwC for its generous support of this series and of our Digital Dialogue Conference. Our moderator this morning is Lisa Coleman. Lisa is a partner in PwC's Audit and Assurance Group and part of the firm's Technology, Communications, Entertainment, and Media Practice. Please join me in welcoming Lisa Coleman.
Thank you, and welcome to the second breakfast session. I look forward to an interesting dialogue this morning. I am going to really promote that we have a dialogue, so if there are any questions or points that you would like to make in the audience, we would be more than happy to hear from you. So I'd like to introduce our panelists today. So I'm going to start at my far left. Ken is from St. Joseph's Media. He has a long history in this industry. He's worked for a number of entrepreneur companies, started companies, and has great experience. St. Joseph's Media is the largest privately held magazine publisher, so can give us a perspective from a publishing perspective. And then I have Cal to my immediate left. He's from PricewaterhouseCoopers in our consulting group. He has spent more than, I think it's 19 to be very precise.
It'll be 20 in
years in the particular topic of today, which we define as business intelligence, but to me it's data mining, understanding how you take all the data you have today and understand how it can help you from a business strategy perspective. So I thought what I would do this morning is just start out with introducing the topic and why it is so important, not that any of you don't understand why it is so important. But you know, nearly 1 minute in five consumers are online and they're in using the social media network for that 1 of 5 minutes. In Canada, we actually are in the top 10, believe it or not, we're in the top 10 countries for social networking. So around the world, we actually make the top 10, even though we're a very small country. So we are very social in our use of our mobile devices. And then from the next bullet is actually in Canada. So this again is a Canadian phenomenon. It's not found globally, but in Canada, we expect that internet advertising spending will actually overcome your traditional TV spending in the near term. If you look out across the rest of the world, these two are not expected to intersect until beyond 2016. So again, a very interesting phenomena for Canada. So you know what we found when we looked at our outlook this year? As you all know, the consumers are wanting and demanding more compelling, more immersive, and more increased sharing opportunities. So you're now dealing with a connected consumer that wants and demands content when they want it, where they want it, and how they want it. So how do you use that to your advantage? So how do you make data and advertising more compelling to your consumer so that they act in a way you want them to act? So what we want to talk today is about exactly that. How do you use analytics? How do you use the tools that are available in order to understand all the data you have and how you can use that in your business or your activities of the day? So I'm going to ask Cal to talk to this slide as our expert on analytics and the three, when I talked to him before we came together today, I said to him, there's a lot of noise out there around big data, little data, all these buzzwords in this space. Can you help us understand what all of that means in a simple fashion so that, you know, you can start to think about how you might use the tools that are available today in your businesses? So Cal?
Good morning. So analytics is about getting closer to your customers, so I'm going to come down there and get closer to the audience. I'm more comfortable in interacting with you guys anyway. So really about analytics is understanding behaviors and patterns within the customers and consumers that you're dealing with. So I'd like to ask you guys a question. How many people typically drive to work, just by a show of hands? How many people take the same route to work every day? Right, most of you. We're creatures of habit. We develop things that we enjoy, that we're comfortable with, and that's the path that we pursue. Now, having said that, there's a whole new world out there that things are evolving. But in general, what analytics will tell you, that past performance is an indicator of future performance. Meaning that when you would discover something about how people behave, the odds are they're highly predisposed to continue that behavior once you understand it. So it's not just about knowing customers and consumers, it's about understanding them and understanding all the things that they like to do based on the dynamics that they have around them. Who in the room is doing anything analytic related? Okay, well, that's good. So analytics is a very broad subject, and it's certainly evolving. Things are changing from the perspective of there's so many more data points to gather now. Certainly gathering what people are doing online and behaviors, what they're saying, what they're doing, what their preferences and behaviors are. But having said that, there are some fundamental principles that need to be in place. And it's interesting, all the IT vendor community is talking about big data. And that's great because there's some new technologies that are in place that make it easier to handle large volumes of data. But part of the challenge is we haven't done a good job on little data. So there needs to be a better job to take care of the fundamentals and really understand how you can marry up these three types of technologies from an effectiveness perspective. Because it's not just about latching your cart to something and saying, okay, we're going to go off down this path because everyone's talking about this and we better be on board. I read an article the other day that talked about, oh, everybody's doing this, you better do it or else you're going to be behind. And it's sort of, I'm not sure why they were driving at that, I suspect, and my apologies if I'm talking too loud for you. I tend to project. But what happened in that case is that here's an article written by a consulting firm that's trying to push some business and services. It was more like an advertisement saying, you need to do this or else you're going to be left behind. And I don't think that's entirely true, because at the end of the day, whatever analytics that you're going to be doing and you're going to be pursuing, it's about the business purpose behind it. Why are you doing this? Don't just do it because you think everybody else is, because the odds are that a lot of those folks have no idea why they're doing it either. They're just jumping in and trying to get it done. So again, you come back to the basic fundamental from a business perspective of what's the premise for doing this. So let me contrast the three different components of business intelligence that are on the board. We're talking about social business intelligence. That's pretty self-explanatory. It's looking at the sentiment of what's being said out there. And that's generally listening on a macro as well as a micro level to understand what people are saying, what the trends are, what's the next greatest thing. But more specifically, the real value is when you get down, and it's an old term in the BI world, business intelligence world, getting to the segment of one, of understanding that customer and consumer. And it's important to understand the overall trend. But then in getting down to a granular level, how do my customers individually relate to this trend and what's their perspectives on it? Because just because something is a trend, it may not be the most prevalent thing and relevant to your consumer base or the customers that you're after and trying to understand. So you need to balance that. Traditional business intelligence is really broken down across three levels, three different areas. One is at the decision-making, the operational level. So when you've got sort of, let's say, a manufacturing organization, you've got a number of widgets going through the process, you want to be able to effectively count the widgets. One here, one there, know where they are at any point in time. For argument's sake, and I'm not a media expert by any stretch of the imagination, it's not my focus industry, but I'm looking at programming as content, as the product. So you want to understand where that product is at any point in the continuum from a interaction with your consumer base. Are they a loyal customer? Are they a one-timer? There's different ways to look at customer behavior relative to your product environment. So the second component of traditional business intelligence is really looking at performance measurement, counts and amounts. How's the business doing? Rather than understand where the widgets are, how many widgets are we actually moving through the organization this year versus last year? So it's looking at key performance indicators and traditional measures, both financial, customer, and operational. So that's more of the and that's one of the more prevalent performance management uses of traditional business intelligence. The third piece is now what I call advanced analytics. And that's where you're using statistical modeling and analytical modeling against the data environment to understand what the likelihood of events occurring going forward. So you look at past outcomes and you try and predict what future outcomes will be. And that's at a customer basis. So relevant to the subject of the day, it's about customer analytics and understanding what are my customer behaviors, what are their preferences, what have they done in the past, and what are they likely to respond to in the future. One of the most prevalent uses of customer analytics is around campaign management. So I'm sure a lot of you get certain campaigns and stimulus to do things with customer companies that you deal with. Those are all, well, I shouldn't say all, but a good part of them are driven on analytical models that determine how likely are you to purchase this product. One of the big industries for using analytics is the telco industry and wireless. They're looking at your wireless accounts and your behaviors and trying to understand who's likely to move or churn to another organization, who's likely to leave, and what vulnerability do we have across our entire customer index. Based on that, then they determine what marketing program to apply to you based on your vulnerability level and your value to the organization. Okay, everybody with me so far? So we've covered the first two. We got sentiment, we got a whole bunch of analytics in traditional BI, and then we've got the latest buzzword, big data. What exactly does that mean? So in a nutshell, it really is the marriage of all the structured data that we have, all data that is codified, or for lack of a better term, data that is specific, that, you know, date of birth, sex, name, address, number of products purchased, things that are quantified in a database somewhere. That's structured data. Unstructured data is free-form text. So when you've got a whole bunch of web pages that people are entering information into, all of that free-form text presents a problem from an analysis perspective. It's harder to go through all that free-form text to develop the patterns and related understanding. The value of big data is bringing some relatively inexpensive approaches from a software, hardware, and management perspective to be able now to marry up the unstructured data with the structured data. So that is, in a sense, where the industry is going. The real value, then, you could argue that big data is a combination of social BI and traditional BI to some extent. However, don't be swayed by the vendor marketplace. Big data has been going on for a very long time. All we need to do is look at Walmart. They have one of the largest data warehouses in the world. Actually, I think it is the largest commercial data warehouse in the world. They've optimized and managed and changed their entire business model based on data and understanding how their customers interact with the organization, what products they purchase, when they purchase them. And they've used that, as I said earlier, to change the way that they conduct their business. And they did this long before the concept of big data was out there. So there are a lot of different ways to do things. And my final point that I'll make is that there is no one right way to do business intelligence. The bottom line, there are a lot of different paths to get there. The real key is understanding what's the business purpose. What are we trying to achieve? What's the business value in linking up all these different pieces of data? And sometimes you don't need to have a specific hypothesis, but you need to understand from a scenario basis, where do we think we're going with this and what do we want to achieve? What I would submit is from a customer analysis perspective, I think your industry is changing quite a bit in that you used to be going through like distributors. I look at you as wholesalers from a programming perspective. You go through distributors. Well, now you're going direct to the customer. That represents, you're becoming a retailer in a sense. And that presents a whole new challenge for understanding what are my customers looking for? What are they more apt to buy? And how are they likely to, what affinities are present within customer preferences? So what's the second, third, and fourth program they're likely to buy based on the interests of what I understand that they're enjoying to do? Are there any questions? Was that fairly clear? Great. Okay. And with that, I'll hand things over to Ken.
Great. So now that we've had an introduction to the technical side, we'd be interested in Ken talking a little bit about how you use information today to drive business strategies.
Sure. And I'm going to sit, partially because I'm a sedentary creature by nature. And then also because one of the things that I think that we should probably talk about when it comes to analyzing business data is A/B testing. And that's doing two different things and measuring the outcomes of each. If you take the same route into work every morning, it's not likely that you're going to learn a lot about how to get to work in the morning. You have to take different routes and find out which one is faster, that sort of thing. So I'm VP Digital for St. Joseph Media, meaning that I oversee all of our website properties, social media, mobile platforms. I look at a lot of analytics every day. It's a big part of what I do in my job. And when we talk about information overload, that's essentially a big part of what we have. It reminds me of a joke. Guys, ready for a joke at 9 o'clock in the morning? Okay. Everyone's like, a joke about data analytics? It's pretty brave. So Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson go on a camping trip. And after they've had their meal for the evening and they get into their sleeping bags for the night, separate bags, it's not that kind of a joke, they settle in for the evening. And several hours later, Holmes shakes Watson awake. And he says, Watson, look up at the sky and tell me what you see. Watson looks up and he says, "Oh, I see millions of stars." And Holmes says, "Well, what can you deduct from that?" And Watson says, "Well, I don't know. I guess geographically, depending on where the North Star is in relation to the horizon, I can say we're at about 48 degrees north latitude." And Holmes says, "No, something more." And he says, "Well, I guess meteorologically, I can deduct that since it's a clear night, we'll probably have nice weather tomorrow." And Holmes says, "No, something more fundamental and important." And Dr. Watson says, "I guess philosophically, given that there are millions of stars, our place in the universe is rather insignificant." Holmes says, "No." So Watson says, "Well, what is it?" So Holmes leans back and looks up the stars and says, "It would appear that someone has stolen our tent." And I think that that's the problem of analytics. You can get so deeply into looking at any one particular thing or be baffled by the overall number of things that it's possible to look at that you can miss the fact that someone has stolen your tent. It's not that hard to build a popular website that a lot of people will come to. All you need to do is have pictures of Justin Bieber or cats eating cheeseburgers or put somebody in the bushes and try to catch Kate Middleton on vacation. But there's a question about what ultimate goal you're trying to serve, what you're trying to do at the end of the day. And I think that that's something that you have to realize is more important. What's the purpose? And you can talk about that as the business reasons for why you do things. But being most of us are in media, and we don't always do things because we want them to be popular or we want them to make as much money as possible. There's often a deeper purpose that we're trying to achieve in everything that we do. So I think that it's important to keep that in mind, not to get so deeply into the analytics that you miss your tent and keep your focus on the things that you're actually trying to achieve. Analytics are like, all the stuff that we get from Google Analytics. It's like baseball. You can keep trying to delve deeper into all the different stats that you have, but finding that money ball equation, the things that's really important to figuring out your business and how you're going to do things, is the thing that's actually important at the end of the day. For me, the thing that I really look at is visits from returning visitors. You know, you can look at unique visits to your website or page views to your website, and all those things are certainly important, especially when you're talking about driving revenue. Revenue is ultimately driven by page views because that's the way advertising is purchased. But if you get too focused on, you know, the amount of traffic you got on any one particular day, it can be a bit deceiving. It'd be like there being an accident on the 401 and there being a massive pileup of traffic there and someone saying, look at all these people, this would be a great place to open a restaurant. That's not true because, of course, they're only there for that one day at that one time. You need to know how many people are returning to your website, the type of audience that you're building up, because at the end of the day, that's what's important is audience and how engaged people are, not just on a particular day at a particular time, but overall, what's their continuing relationship with you, whether it's through your website, through your social networks, or anything like that.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the analytical tools that are out there and some of the new buzzwords. We've talked about, you know, from a business perspective, how you want to take your data, use that data to optimize and decide, or use that data in your business in order to address one of your strategic business objectives. One of the things we always hear, you've got data overload. Everyone knows that. Everyone can feel that pain as they probably, you know, even now you can probably open your devices and see, oh my God, I've got 10 new messages. What are some of the challenges though? Because what we hear in this industry around this is, yes, it is an important topic, but there are some challenges. So I just want to put on the table what we hear as the challenges and ask the panelists to speak to that. So some of the things, particularly in Canada, we have this Privacy Act that we have to abide by. And so you have a huge amount of privacy issues in Canada around data. So can you actually get at the right data around an individual or not because of the privacy issues we have? So, you know, in some cases, you're not even allowed to ask for their birthday unless they give you permission to take that data. You know, I'll go back to shopping on the weekend. They always are now asking for your email. My mother always says no, whereas I will be a little more willing to give it. My daughter, absolutely no problem. So you even get the generation barriers to data. And so that goes to the second point. There always are concerns from consumers about how you're going to use your data. You know, another really good example is I volunteer with a not-for-profit, and we're always talking about selling our list of donors. And that, you know, that does happen in the not-for-profit world. People realize that, but people don't want that to happen. They want the right to give you permission to sell their donor information to another charity. So that's a good example of perhaps inappropriate or appropriate data. And then, obviously, the high-profile breaches. I'll use my mother. I'm never going to give my credit card out over the internet because, you know, those Facebook guys, they lose our data. You know, so you've heard of the highly publicized, someone lost their computer in the airport and it had important data on it. So different generations think differently about security and whether someone will breach data that's on portable devices. Also, as we get more portable, there's a higher risk that data is going to get lost around the transportability of that data. So I'd be interested from the two of you what you've heard around barriers in these three areas or others on what people are hearing, honing down to getting to the fine-tuned data that we need in order to predict and use in our businesses.
So I could start with from a privacy perspective. I'm currently working within the provincial government in one of the health organizations, and privacy is ridiculously stringent level to guard our personal information. Now, that is a noble purpose and something to achieve. However, it stifles their ability to understand overall patterns and trends of the general population. So there needs to be a balance between the two. From an obligation perspective, the legislation says that you're not allowed to gather information and use it for purposes other than it was originally gathered for. So if someone is signing on for a particular purpose, you can manage their data as long as it pertains to that original purpose. Now, a lot of retail organizations are moving towards identifying the individual consumer or the customer. That's been the big challenge in the retail marketplace because people come in anonymously and they can buy products with cash. So it becomes just a market basket and you don't really know who that individual is. The only thing you can infer is based on the products that they purchased, based on the affinities between those products, we can presume that it looks like this type of person and therefore we're dealing with this type of marketplace. So whenever you can get your consumers to self-identify and sign up with some sort of loyalty program, and then establish a profile for themselves. That's always the best way to go, and it's the first step from a customer analytics understanding to understand who your customers are. But at the same time, you need to explain to them, here's how we're gonna use your information, so you need to have an explicit privacy statement. In addition, is get their permission for how you're gonna use it, but also have them understand we're not gonna sell your information or we're not gonna use it in means and manners that are sort of clandestine and that you wouldn't be aware of. And it will be used to provide you with additional value.
Look, I'm a big fan of privacy. And I think that the desire and drive to continually push the bounds of what information companies want to have about you and how to sell things to you and market directly to you is more than anything a symptom of otherwise failing business models. If we were all making lots of money doing things, then we wouldn't have to say, in order to make our business profitable, we have to know your birthday, where you live, how you shop, how many children you have. It's a symptom of almost desperation in industry as a whole in needing to drive further and further into the realms of our homes and minds in order to make what we do otherwise profitable business. I think that when it comes to privacy, and obviously there are lots of regulations in place, in my world it generally comes into play when we're sending out emails or keeping customer data on our servers because of member passwords, that sort of thing. And of course, there was a big breach on Gawker last year where tons of user passwords were retrieved by anonymous. And then the problem, of course, then being that lots of people use the same username and password on a lot of sites. So even though you signed up for Gawker, now your Facebook, banking, all of that information is also now breached. So I try to gather as little private data as possible. I like to outsource that and keep it away from me if I can at all. When people do participate and give me information about themselves on Facebook, for instance, is a big one, or Twitter, I want to make sure that they're getting something out of it and that they are driving it and they understand why they're giving that information over. I don't want to fool people into giving me information about them so that I can then sell them, a car better. I want to make sure that they're giving me information because they want to be a member of my community. They want to participate. They get something out of it and should be driven by the consumer rather than the business needs of the organization to sell things better to people.
And that's a great segue into the final point on this slide. We interviewed a number of people globally and then more recently here in Canada around is there a fair way to get people's data yet recognize some of the barriers. And what we found is exactly what Ken just said. Make sure there's a win-win solution where you're getting good information but you're giving back to them something that they want. And the best example is what Cal used is around the loyalty programs. And so we recently interviewed Cineplex, and if you've been to the theater recently, they always ask for your scene card. And that to them was a very successful program in order for them to get more data. They have apparently, well, they do have 70 million people that go through their theaters a year. So think about that asset, understanding who those people are, why they're there, and then connecting them very specifically to other opportunities within the Cineplex organization. So if you went and saw James 2 weekends ago, you're probably likely to want to get the movie on a download when it becomes available. So taking that information and sending you a very targeted email. Let me tell you, that would work for my husband. He would buy it instantly if they sent him a very specific email that says, James is now available through the iTunes or through the obviously Cineplex wants to sell it through their website. But, you know, it's that down, it's the direct, we know you were in our theater, we know you're interested, here's the next revenue opportunity. So loyalty programs we saw over and over again as successful getting data in order to give back what customers want.
And just to take that a step further, really there's three things from a revenue perspective that you're looking to drive. One is revenue enhancement, and that is how do I get them to buy more of what they already buy? Revenue extension, how can I get them to buy new things, sort of cross-sell, that they don't currently use? And then revenue retention, how can I get them to stay as customers and be happy and continue using my service? So those are the big three from a business case perspective. You add cost avoidance and cost displacement to the equation, and that's really how you build out what are we trying to get to and what's the benefit to our organization for doing this. So when you understand your customers, that's where you're going down that path for a greater understanding of what the impact to the bottom line is.
So now I'd like to open it up to the audience, and George has a mic here.
Good morning, thank you. My first question is, with film and television products, which I think a lot of us do, proving the ROI is tough, right? Because there isn't necessarily a direct purchase. Furthermore, the analytics that have been used to tell us how many people are watching said program are, some would argue, maybe defunct or maybe not as indicative. So I'm wondering, I think it's the challenge that I have with my clients is to really show the, to be able to pull the data from all these different places to really show that it actually is worthwhile to spend money, perhaps in social arenas, to drive, let's say, viewership or engagement with programs. And then I'm wondering if you have any of these kind of clients and what kind of tools and suggestions you have on helping us, because I know it works, but to prove it 100% is so difficult.
Mm-hmm. And maybe I'll frame the question to help the panelists. So I think what you're saying is, you know, when we had traditional measurement tools if you were selling to a broadcaster, and now because you have to go across the media platforms, the transmedia, some of those measurement tools have not caught up with the need to be able to turn that into actual revenue or ROI as you defined it.
No, that wasn't quite the question. So the question is, how do we prove that the efforts that we're making in the digital space is actually driving perhaps viewership?
Okay.
And that viewership is changed. It's not necessarily people are tuning in at 9 o'clock on Thursday nights. How do we do that?
Yep.
Okay. So if I could start,
sure,
just
go
if
ahead.
I may. So I think the problem that you have is a classic retail example. You're Procter & Gamble.
Right.
You're generating a ton of products, but you're not selling them directly to the consumer.
Right.
Traditionally, they're going through distribution centers, through retailers, to reach the consumer. And there's always been that age-old discussion between the producers and the retailers. Mm-hmm. How do we know? How can we get more information?
Right.
And that's always been a challenge. There are vehicles, though. So there's the soft uptake as well as the hard uptake. And what you need to get to is to have consumers self-identify it to some extent that they are using your service, and then use that from a profile perspective to understand how, in general, their behaviors and patterns are across a number of services that you offer across a variety of platforms. Because some customers, and you know, as individuals, there are a lot of commonality. We like to do a lot of the same things. And you'll find that even though people are in the same segment, the way in which they're reached may be different. So if there's an opportunity for two individuals of the same segment to purchase a car, the way to reach them may be a different message in a different medium entirely based on their personal preferences. And the challenge then becomes, and I'm not sure if I'm directly answering your question, but it is a challenge, is to reach out to the end consumer and say, please help us to understand who our what our customer base looks like. And then to understand from a soft perspective all the peripheral types of information that you can gather to infer based on what you're looking for. So there's not a hard and fast rule to say, here's the specific answer. But it's a variety of strategies in order to build a better understanding of what impact you're having in the marketplace.
Just to add to that, the old adage in advertising is, you know that 50% of your advertising is effective, but you don't know which 50%, right? And the thing about all of the analytics and data that we can collect around these things, and there's lots of things. If you're trying to sell your clients, there's certainly lots of data that you can put together. But it's sizzle. It's not steak. Proving the ROI on anything remains very difficult. And the fact that we can now measure things more consistently online is a bit of a smokescreen to measuring the actual ROI for any particular campaign. The ROI on anything will be ultimately measured by the bottom line for the product or service or television program or magazine or website that comes out at the end of the day. Trying to very sort of narrowly measure the ROI on any particular campaign is bad science. It's because there's so many factors going on at any one time, so many variables. Who knows if sales of a product went up or down because of a particular ad campaign or because of conditions in the overall marketplace. It's a wide and vast ecosystem. So I'd say that, you know, trying to, for us in the media, trying to do good work is the most important thing. People know good work when they see it and they interact with it, when they engage with it, and that's how you're going to measure your success. I'd try to convince your clients not to get too bogged down in any particular number, not to measure the success of an online ad campaign by the click-through rate, because that's not necessarily what you're trying to do. You're trying to drive something more holistic. So don't try to get bogged down in too much in the data. Try to do good work that makes people happy and engaged.
Well, that leads nicely to my question, because how are you selling your products to an ad agency if they're looking at page views and clicks and things? How are you convincing them not to look at those? Are you getting any traction with return on engagement? What terms are you using? And you are using a lot of data to sell and private, you know, demographic data, interests and things when you sell.
So, I mean, the thing about specifically with online advertising is that the market has, especially in the last 4-5 quarters, the landscape has changed immeasurably, in particular because of the rise of real-time bidding. What's happening with real-time bidding is that sophisticated advertisers are now have the ability to disintermediate publishers and media companies and target consumers based on some footprint that they have online. So if someone is reading Toronto Life magazine or Forbes magazine, instead of paying the $30 CPM to advertise to that person on that website, you find that same person when they're looking at handlotion.com, where the CPM is a third of a cent, and you sell to that, you put your ad in front of that person on that website. And there's a whole idea now of separating advertising from the content that it's around. One of the reasons why, great television programs or magazines were traditionally able to get higher costs were because they could say, look, we have this wonderful demographic of people, and we have a great product. Putting your brand beside our product will enhance your brand, and you'll make sure that you're talking to the type of people that you want to talk to. That equation is what's changing in our industry right now faster than anything. People are saying, yeah, I'm still interested in that demographic, in that person, but I'm less interested in necessarily making sure that my brand is in a context of content that reaches those persons. I can go off and get those people when they are also on Facebook or handlotion.com or whatever it is. So that's a big, big challenge. So one of the things that we try to do is offer services that you can't buy on a massive scale. You know, there's, if you have money to spend, you can put a billboard, you know, in Nathan Phillips Square or anything like that. But your money would probably be better spent putting together a blog, putting together, generating content around your product and the services that you want to offer, generating real interest in things online rather than just trying to catch people as they drive by or walk by something. So we find that we have much more success these days selling advertisers products that they can't buy on a, you know, advertising stock exchange. We have to give individual service. We have to understand much more deeply the needs of a particular campaign, what people are trying to do, and offer them other things rather than just display advertising.
Thanks very much. I want to jump back. Probably this is an extension of the first question, and speaks a little bit to, I think, some of the biggest barrier that I face coming from the film production and distribution sector, but I think would be somewhat unique to music and book publishing and others as well, which is the barrier that we hit time and time again is having fundamentally incomplete information about our consumers. I mean, you talked about Walmart. If I'm Walmart, I at least understand how my consumer interacts with Walmart. As a producer, I do not have that data on how a consumer interacts with movies. Because as you pointed out, Cineplex doesn't share their information with me, and the individual portals I deal through, Apple will tell me how consumers interact with REST Ventures through Apple, because we're a direct contractor, but they won't tell me how that same consumer reacts with other people's product. And then the second capsule to that is because of the nature of projects that we do are so disconnected, it makes something even simple like A and B testing, which I think is hugely important, difficult, because the consumer for my product is radically different week to week, whether or not I'm selling a kids holiday show, which is primarily, you know, on VOD, or we're selling, you know, a Swedish comedy to art house films. There's no overlap there. There's no outreach to to the audience for section A to section B. So when the only data you have is extremely short-term data and fundamentally incomplete, and even portal aspects like film-specific websites. I mean, we spent several years doing testing on those and found that 99.999% of people who visit film-specific websites want to know where they can buy the film and is it playing in a theater near them, and that's it. And that is the entirety of their interaction. Is there any hope of building a bigger picture of a consumer that can actually carry it forward, or are you just reinventing the wheel every time around?
It's a very good question. Of course, I forgot to put that as a challenge, that a lot of the content you don't actually get at the end consumer because you have to go through a distribution channel, whatever that might be.
We are the distributor, and it's the same.
Yeah, because with the big, big machines out there that drive content. What do you guys...
Well, I mean, I think that to a certain extent, you have to embrace the unknown. You know, there's a British painter, I think in the last 2 years, did a survey where they asked people what they like most in paintings. Do you like landscapes, or do you like portraits? Do you like the color blue or the color red? That sort of thing. And they did a mass sample, and based on what people's expressed preferences were when it came to paintings. They put together a painting based on everything that everyone said that that's what they like in paintings. And it was the most boring, bland, idiotically contrived piece of art that that you could possibly imagine. And one of the things Steve Jobs often said is that people don't know what they want until you show it to them. Right? And that's the job of artists. That's the job of people in the media. But, I mean, I think that one of the things that we're talking about, you know, consumer data and the lifetime history of people, it is great. I mean, if people are coming to the website and asking, you know, where do I buy this, then the best thing to do is to get that person to contribute, to become a member of some sort of club or community who wants to talk about that film, that wants to be engaged in an ongoing basis with the type of art that's going on there. You know, Amazon has this fabulous program. If you liked this book, you'll probably also like these books, right? And I don't know how accurate this is. Netflix, I find, is bizarrely prescient about my tastes in television or film. But the great thing is to, you know, when I watch something on Netflix and then rate it, I'm giving Netflix data about me, and they're using that data not to sell me something, but to help me find more things that I like. And I think that's that has to be the goal. If your goal is simply, you know, 100% driven by you and not driven by the consumer at all, you'll ultimately fail. You have to collect data and create interactions that work for the consumer, that give them what they want, rather than just fulfilling what you want, which is to drive your bottom line and make more money, so on and so forth. So embrace the unknown and get people to participate in the products, and then you'll be able to, you know, hopefully sell them other films that are in the same genre later on. Get them to participate.
So if I could take a try at that, it's you've got a similar challenge, and again, I come back to the wholesale food and CPG manufacturing industry, that they don't have the direct touch to the end customer. You've got a number of products that are targeted at different segments, and sometimes there's no relationship between those individual segments, is what you were saying. It's a challenge when you don't have the visibility into the customer base of who's using what and why are they using it, at what point in time are they using it, and what do they prefer one over the other, and why are they making the decisions? What's driving that decision factor? What the CPG industry did was they created consortiums. And they organize themselves as a collective to go to the end retailer and say, give us some market basket information to help us understand, while we're not identifying the individual, I'm understanding what families and groups of products are being put together in the market basket to determine in a somewhat of an anonymous level about what the behaviors look like. They also engaged in a lot of coupon. That's where the coupon world came in. But not anonymous coupons, in self-identifying coupons. So here's something in it for you. You're going to identify yourself, and I'm going to get a better pattern, a better understanding of the patterns and preferences you have. And here's what I'm willing to offer you and provide you. It's either a discount on your next purchase, or it's some sort of stimulus that's targeted at their segment. So we talked about the Netflix and about Amazon. All they're doing is basic affinity analysis based on your purchase behavior and based on your preferences. So it starts with understanding who is the individual, what segment are they part of. You could do a lot of inference based on very few data elements, because you build up that aggregate across your entire customer base, and you build out to say, I'm starting to develop a good understanding based on the neighborhood that these people are in, based on their preferences. Perhaps we're going to buy some data from a third party to fill in some of the blanks and gaps about people. And in general, in the digital world today, people give up far more information than they ever used to, especially if they're going to figure, if they're going to get something in value in return. They're willing to offer that as barter to say, okay, what's in it for me and what are you willing to provide for me? So if you have a communication strategy in place saying, how are we going to get this information? And it's not just a single prong strategy, it's on multiple levels. You gather that information from a variety of sources, and then you build up quite a nice cadre of understanding of your customer base and your segments. And that will help you then to target programs that cater to the types of segments that are most profitable for your type of products.
And the brilliant thing about that, too, is that it doesn't breach privacy when you get to that level. You know, I'd much rather be identified as, you know, the lefty, techie dad cohort than, you know, Ken Hunt, who likes these six movies cohort.
Yeah. There's a layer of abstraction from that perspective.
So I understand, you know, the use of data for predicting consumer behavior. I come from an advertising background, and it's totally, you know, you can see the logic of that. But how do you explain the fact that, I mean, data is predicated on user behavior and patterns, and as you said, we are all creatures of habit. But this obsession of today's society and younger people and, you know, the new, I guess, demographics coming up with whatever's new, you know, what's exciting, what's changing, how can you predict change of behavior using existing data so that we can use some of that to be able to, because I'm a content producer, film, television, transmedia, and, you know, 50% or 60% or in some cases 80% of our time is actually spent in pitching and trying to convince people that what we plan to do is something that people will want to watch. How do we use existing data to say that something new is what we're giving people?
You can't.
Well, I mean, to a certain extent,
if someone tells you that they can predict the future and they can do it accurately, get a stake and build a fire around them because that person is a witch. You know, there's, it's very, very, I mean, predicting the future is really, really hard, no matter how much data that you're given. So I think that, you know, it's going to be really, really difficult to think that, you know, we can predict the, especially in the changing pace of things, that you can predict what television show teens are going to want to watch 18 months from now so that you can buy the right pilot and put it into production now. I think that you have to place a lot of bets and try out a lot of things. That's the way venture capital works, right? Venture capitalists, if there were venture capitalists out there who said, I know I'm looking for this thing, and if I invest in that, then I'll get rich in 2 years or 18 months, then venture capital would be a really easy thing to do. But instead, venture capitalists look at a wide range of things, and they place bets on a lot of things, and they hope to hit one in 10. And they're okay with having 9 failures. I think that, I mean, maybe Cal has a different opinion, but I think it's really hard to think that we're going to be able to predict the future given the data that we have up to this point.
Fair enough. I agree. The prediction is always a dog's breakfast in a sense. But I have a couple teenagers at home, and their attention span is that of a gnat. I mean, literally, they can move from one thing to the next. They do their homework. They got 5 screens going at once and flipping it. We're really a soundbite society now where you've got a minimal amount of time to get your message across, or else they move on to the next one. But to this point, there is so much more resource available to you to listen to buzz. And that's really what the key is in the past, it used to be sort of within the schools or within, you know, workplaces for a variety of segments and targets you were after. You couldn't get at what the conversation was, what the buzz was. Well, today that's out in the open. Facebook, you know, if you look at the nature of what it's about, it's brilliant in that it's just capturing what people like to do, is interact with each other. Now, sometimes that's too extreme, but that's a different question. But if you are listening, you can typically figure out what are some of the latest emerging trends, what is really getting the chatter going, what's mentioned most frequently, what are the key things that people are talking about. So there is an avenue for you to reach out into the sort of society at large to understand what the buzz is. The challenge is relating that to what segments you're after. Because just because a whole group of people are talking about a particular subject, that may not be related to the targets that you're after. And so you have to hone in on, based on the segments that we're targeting for our business, this is what they're talking about. So it's not just a global, you know, put your ear to the on a glass on the wall and listen to what they're saying. It's understanding who's saying it and what's the relevance to what my product is and what I'm trying to accomplish. Now, that's about focus. So you're not trying to be everything to everybody, right? Did we answer your question?
Yes and no. I mean, in reality, the questions really should be posed to the people we try to pitch to, because they need to understand that this is as much
you know, it's as much a guess. They need to understand that the same sort of information that we're working with, and I guess it's convincing right. them.
So the final point on that is we have the greatest amount of consumer sentiment information that we've ever had before. It's a great opportunity. And you need now to marry that up with a whole bunch of other things to really not just know what they're saying, but understand what they're saying. That's really what the challenge is, because putting it all in a database and culling through it, you can determine a lot of patterns and things that people are saying, but really understanding what's driving it and the drivers are really where the key value is.
One thing that I would say is that, especially on the web, and I'm not sure how many people here are engaged in the web specifically, but one thing that never goes out of style is being useful to people. And that's one thing that we really try to focus on rather than just figuring out, you know, what stories we should cover or anything like that. Trying to build products that are actually useful to people, keep them coming back. So there are lots of websites out there with horrible design that, you know, are laughable attention to detail when it comes to pixel perfect anything, but they remain incredibly popular because there's something about them that drives repeat behavior, and quite often that's because those things are useful to people. They go back there because they serve a purpose in their lives. So that's okay. I mean, much more difficult when you're talking about film or television. You're, you know, harder to make a television program that actually helps people solve a problem in their life. On the web, when we're trying to build products, we can do that. We can identify problems and find consumers, find people who need that problem solved and build things for them.
Okay, it is the end of our hour. I thought I would summarize what we heard this morning, and then the panelists will stay for additional questions.
She already has a microphone.
Sorry. Go ahead. Okay.
I just had a legal question related to all of this.
Question.
So if I've been able to collect your information and I have your personal contact information, do I need to be concerned about the new anti-spam legislation?
It's about permission marketing. And if they've given you consent to contact them in a certain way about certain types of products, it's an opt-in versus just a blanket to start sending everything to everybody. Now, I'm not familiar with the details of the legislation, but in general, I know that if I've got a whole list of customers out there, I don't want to upset them. I don't want to bombard them with things that aren't relevant to them. So it's about identifying what's relevant, what are the key messages for them at that particular point in time.
I'm pretty familiar with the legislation, and yes, you do need to be worried about it. You need to make sure that if you have an opt-in list, that you have proof of those opt-ins, that you have the ability to have people opt out with one click, and that you don't contact them anymore, that you have another part of the legislation is that people need to be able to contact a real person on the phone to address a problem that they have if they haven't been removed from a list. So they have to have your contact information. You have to make sure that you have proof of the opt-in. And I'd say that when it comes to this anti-spam legislation, that it's best to, you know, be cautious and act like a reasonable party. Don't try to, you know, push the boundaries when it comes to these things. It's not going to be generally people like us who get dinged by this legislation first. It's going to be the bad actors, the people who are in the, you know, essentially the telemarketing, the spam industry, who are the ones who get dinged first by this legislation. As long as we behave reasonably and intelligently about dealing with the people, then we'll probably be fine. But you should definitely keep an eye on those things and continue to act like reasonable people.
Just quickly ask one question.
We're okay going over it.
Just 1 minute. Who's making the big money on this? Like, who has unlocked new value using this data in media? Like, we've heard a lot of stories about dollars for pennies and everything else. Where, like, is there any case where someone's unlocking a lot of money on this? I'm not talking about Target or Walmart. I'm talking about media companies.
Well, you know, it's a good question. I think what you'll find is the people that are digital to begin with are successful, but if you're trying to convert a traditional model to a digital model, we're still trying to find the answer. So, you know, I think the I think it's to come. I was just recently at MIPCOM in France, and this was the biggest topic, is where are the revenue models? How are we going to find the revenue models? And how are we going to be successful? You know, and everyone said, we recognize that we have to be there, but they're not found yet because it's high volume, low dollars, and the traditional, particularly in Canada, the traditional models are still the most successful. And so it's, I don't know. I mean,
if you consider Amazon a media company, then and they're becoming more and more of a media company, and they're innovating. You know, the creation of not only the Kindle but Amazon Singles. You know, Amazon is doing very well in terms of creating products and ways to consume media that people like. And you know, Amazon has just published Tim Ferriss's new book, The 4-Hour Cook, completely disintermediating the rest of the publishing industry because they have that direct relationship with consumers and they have lots of data. You know, the question of, you know, who in the media is making big money from, you know, analyzing consumer data is sort of encompassed by the bigger question of who in the media is making a lot of money. And there's not a lot of companies that are making a lot of money in the media. The ground is changing really quickly. Every media company out there needs to evolve quickly and find ways to do more things and do them better. And it's, you know, and it's not going to be a place where you can, you know, take a foreign correspondent and print that in a newspaper beside a Doonesbury cartoon and classified ads for housing and, you know, buy a mansion in Rosedale. That's not the world we live in anymore. Ground changes too quickly. So we all have to figure out new business models, new ways of communicating with customers and new ways of selling things.
So and if I could just offer one example, Disney would be probably the only organization that's really taken it from.
You've got to find a good Canadian example.
Well, I don't have a Canadian example, but and Disney may not be a similar to the business model that you're operating in, but they have a number of different properties, and they're learning from each. Well, exactly, but they're learning from each of their individual properties to the collective to understand what is our consumer footprint.
So we're going to, I love that topic because it's 12 months from now, we're going to have a panel on where we found the models in Canada around that because it is a very burning platform. But I do want to finish and summarize what we heard today because we're over our time. I think there were some very important points that we heard today. We all are facing data overload and it's understanding how to use that data to link it to business objectives. I had a conversation with Cal before we started. You know, it's getting it outside of the IT shop and really linking data to the objectives. What do you want to achieve from the data analysis? And I think the other one that we heard very importantly is look for the win-wins, particularly to get at your consumer. If you are stuck where you have to go through an intermediate, you know, the meat in the middle, what are things, ideas you can use to get at the end consumer that don't offend the people in the middle that you're selling to, but yet get you that most important data? And consumers are looking more and more for the win-win. They're not going to give you that very granular data unless they get something back in return. And then that deals with some of the anti-spam issues and some of the privacy issues because the person has given you permission to use their data because they realize they're getting something back in return. The win-win to me is the most important. A couple of the content people that we spoke to more recently have actually developed blogs, loyalty programs, et cetera, around their content, even though they're selling through the traditional models still heavily. And then we will, in the future panels, talk about where are the business models, because it is the next big challenge. Thank you very much to our two panelists today. I really appreciate you coming out and giving us some great insights. And thank you all for spending the morning with us.